You know, yeah, scratching my head, but I've never been smart enough to know when I've been out of my depth, which has been a lot.
And so, as you progress through your career building this business that you've got, is it a scalable business that you've got? Is it something that you can continue to grow and grow? Or is it really hard to find people to be really good teachers of negotiation?
It's scalable. We're working on specifically deciding what the attributes are, the people in a different job, right seat, right person, right seat, right, get it, want it, need it. Do they get it? Do they want it? Do they have the capacity to do it? Is one of our rules from Entrepreneurial Operating System. They might have the capacity, but they don't want to do it. I got a lot of former hostage negotiators have the capacity, just don't feel like doing it. Or they don't need it. Or, any one of a number of reasons. So finding somebody that has the capacity and wants it. Another thing that's really hard is, it reminds me of the movie The Matrix, when they're waking people up. And Morpheus says to Neo, we have trouble waking people up after a certain age because they can't adapt. Like, we're taking hostage negotiators that get 20, 30 years of experience, and we want them to rethink everything that they learned. Yeah. And that they haven't been caught off guard in a long time, and they are not used to that. And understanding that skill set is just with a little bit of tweak, it fits right in because it's human nature. And so when we wake them up, it takes a little bit too. And find somebody that's willing to be woken up.
Which industries typically contact you to do business with you? Which industries are your top three or four?
Well, we've probably done more in the healthcare space than anywhere else. Some of that may have been that's been such a turmoil in the United States with all the changes in healthcare for the last 10 years or so, that they're a little more willing to look from the outside or looking for help from the outside. But we really don't focus on industries. We focus on top performers, what we refer to as the 1%. Those are the people we go after. And you could be doing anything. You could be in real estate. You could be mergers and acquisition. You could be an attorney. But if you're into learning, you're going to end up in the top 1%. And it's not just learning by doing, but it's people that seek out somebody that could teach them because they want to accelerate their learning curve. If you're into learning, and you could be doing anything, you could be a car salesman, it doesn't matter. We're after what we refer to is the 1%, which are really people that are into learning. They like making the world a better place. They like making a very good living, but that's not what drives them, because whatever they're doing is eminently satisfying, and they want to get better at it. And it has this great residue where people are actually helped. I was at a reception in Phoenix 6 months ago. The owner of a private jet company is opening up a place in Phoenix to this big reception, for the high-end buyer at a hangar. Mm-hmm. Both the owner of the jet company and his top salesman had both read Never Split the Difference. Mm-hmm. And his top salesman, and they're talking with me about this in front of me. Mm-hmm. The top salesman used my skills to negotiate his compensation package with his boss, who is standing right there, and they're both good with it.
Love that.
That's exactly what you want. When both parties use the skills and they're both good with it.
Because they're respecting it's a skill. They're really respecting it's a skill rather than being played.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Then they didn't get played.
Yeah.
They both ended up in a better place.
I think for me, a lot of the time there'll be some form of negotiation where there's a winner and a loser. And to me, that's not a negotiation. To me, the best outcome is everybody wins. Because if everybody wins, everybody walks away happy.
And they'll want to do it again.
Yeah, and if you can create that in your business with everybody you do business with, in whichever capacity that is, that's a really nice life to live. Just as a human being, that's a nice life to live. I'll give an example. It's like I coach some people in the financial services industry in the UK. okay? And I coach them in life insurance, for example. And I'm like, the better job you do for somebody, the more money you will earn. We agree that, yeah. But the better job you do for somebody, the better off they will be. How beautiful is that? You can earn the most amount of money by doing the very best thing for them. Get your head around that. And you're into a world of absolute joy from going to work every day.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you create, it's like you create the ultimate win-win. And I see, you know, there's different types of sales, and I think that the insurance as one is kind of like a fear-based sale a lot of the time.
Interesting, yeah. Yep.
You know, so if you don't have life insurance and you die, then your family are fucked, you know. They really are. Who's going to pay the mortgage if you die, you know, all that kind of stuff. What have they got to live on? Your wife's got three kids and she's trying to bring them up and you're no longer here. Yeah. All because you didn't get it. And so for me, like life insurance and critical illness insurance, these things are necessary. But the reason most people don't have them is that the people selling them are doing the please sir, would you like to buy some insurance sale? Rather than thinking about the consequences of that particular buyer if they don't buy. You know, and I say, if it was your brother or your sister or your mum and your dad, would you talk to them that way? They're like, well, no. And I'm like, well, why wouldn't you talk to them the same way? If your mum or your dad was doing something stupid, would you tell them?
Yeah.
I would. So when it comes to your client, if they're doing something stupid, surely the outcome for them is a bad outcome.
Right.
So why not give them something that gives them a great outcome?
Right.
At the end of the day, it's a little bit of money. But that security goes there. And so when it comes to negotiation, it's always, for me, it's always that kind of, have that process in your mind, you know, everyone wins. If everyone wins, you know, and whether you're negotiating for stuff that was, you know, way above my category with being a hostage negotiator and stuff, but in business, give everyone a win-win. If you can make that happen, then everyone leaves happy.
Yeah, and they want to do it again.
Ah, the other thing, yeah, do it again. How long have you been doing it as a business teaching after you left for the police?
Well, we theoretically and technically, like I left the FBI in 2007, okay, and incorporated the business. I was in school at the time, yeah, but I incorporated the business 3 months later. So I went back and I did some more schooling. And as soon as I got out, my son and I started to let people know about the idea before the book came out. That really started in 2008, but we couldn't get any traction until the book came out in 2016.
So you kind of plodded away into, because you weren't a businessman, were you? At the end of the day, you didn't have that background.
Nope.
And in 2016, the book came out, and then all of a sudden, people were like, "Oh yeah, this is interesting."
Yeah, it started to gather steam. I mean, we just got more and more traction. Then our marketing got better. It was principally my son and I. Another guy who now is full-time coaching with us, Derek, was helping some. But we weren't generating enough income to keep us afloat. And then my daughter-in-law came in and took over the marketing for us and a lot of our organization. My son and I are not particularly organized. You know, we continued to build the team out. And we continued just to get more traction. And we worked hard and we learned. And we just, you know, the book is a phenomenal marketing device, but it's not enough by itself. And we've been learning ever since. And then we really took off in terms of building capacity and handling demand when we switched to the operating system, the business operating system, which is EOS. I had no idea what a difference that was going to make to have an actual operating system. Like anybody that's in a company, if they haven't got an actual system that's been designed, and there are other versions of this, EOS isn't the only one. But you are not doing as well as you could do without a specific system that somebody designed. And just because you made it up as you went, maybe yours is pretty good, but you're missing pieces. And we're at the point now where if we're leery of partnering up with anybody that's not running EOS, and if we do any sort of, now we're looking to make deals where I'm not going to coach you for money, I'm going to coach you for equity. And you have to put EOS into your business. I do not want a piece of anybody's business that's not running EOS or that's a similar system.
That's smart.
Because we, you know, it makes you, Nassim Nicholas Taleb wrote a book called Anti-Fragile. Mm. An operating system makes you anti-fragile. Mm-hmm. When the pandemic started, mm-hmm. like everybody else, like it, night fell fast. You know, it was March-ish. We went from, you know, it's the flu to shutdown in like 3 weeks. 90% of our revenue stream shut off. I mean, just turn the faucet off. And because of EOS, we pivoted online. We set back up in a month and a half, and we had a profitable year. We didn't make as much as we made the year before, but you shut off 90% of your revenue and you stand up a new operation in 60 days. You only do that if you got a system, and we had a system.
Remember, you don't get in life what's fair, you get what you negotiate. If you want to become a better negotiator, click the link in the description below.
So human behavior is human behavior, period.
What is that triad?
Well, the way I learned it way back then was, you know, there's the victim, the protector, and the persecutor. And someone who comes on a hotline really portraying themselves as a victim, they're trying to draw you into being the protector or to give advice. You know, I need your advice, might be what they would literally say. And then if you're dumb enough to give advice, then they switch from being the victim to the persecutor and they attack you for your advice. And then as soon as you back off, then they go back to being a victim again to try to lure you into giving them advice so that they can attack your advice. And so what they told us, you know, the earmarks of watch out for somebody trying to lure you into giving advice versus being a great sounding board, helping them discover the answer on their own. And then in 2002, much later, I ran across Jim Camp's book, Start With No, and he talked about effectiveness in business negotiation, helping your counterpart discover the best answer. Because if they discover something that's mutually beneficial versus if you offer it, if they discover it, it's their idea and they're going to do it. If you offer it, you're giving them advice and they got no emotional ownership and they're less likely to do it. So he called it helping them discover the best deal. And back in the on the hotline days, it was just guided discovery, helping them discover the best outcome.
From those 3 years volunteering at the suicide prevention line, was there anything else that you really learned about the nature of human beings that has stayed with you still to this day in business and your days as an FBI negotiator?
Yeah, well, you know, still actually going back and pulling the lessons out of it. And it's, you know, people are their thoughts are most dominated by loss. What are they worried about losing? What's their vision of loss over the future? Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in 2002. Behavioral prospect theory, economic Nobel Prize on human behavior, which is loss looms larger than gain. Some people are putting it at a 2-to-1 ratio. Nobody ever puts it at less than 2-to-1. Loss thinks twice as much as an equivalent gain. I've heard people talk about it being as much as 9-to-1, which is why researchers are having trouble putting an exact number on it. So somewhere between 2 and 9 times loss, your vision of the loss is going to determine your behavior. And that was really, we taught on a hotline and taught on hostage negotiation, look for the loss. Somebody's taken hostages, they've suffered a personal identity loss somewhere along the line, and there's probably a triggering event in the last 24 to 48 hours. But look for the loss. And then Kahneman comes across in 2002, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Tversky had died by the time they awarded the Nobel Prize, which is why he didn't get it along with Kahneman, because they're not giving it after somebody's died. Saying that, no, this is just human behavior, period. Period. Not just
hostages, not just people in crisis, but it's the single dominating influence of all human decision making. Not the only influence, just the biggest. And so learning how to cope with that on a hotline is exactly what we're doing these days in all our interactions.
Is there a way to like leverage that to your favor when you're negotiating with someone?
You can. You have to be really careful with it, which is really the whole reason to be in, use empathy as an approach. Because if you don't use empathy, then you're the hostage taker. Or you're trying to use leverage against them. I mean, it's such a blunt force trauma concept that if you don't do it gently, with empathy versus sympathy, you know, empathy is not the same as sympathy. But you're going to seem like a hostage taker yourself if you start out by saying, like, look, man, I know you got a lot to lose if you don't make this deal. Well, that's trying to trigger loss, but I seem like a hostage taker myself if I do that. So I got to work my way into a position where I got to get you to realize that that's the case.
Implementation. In any business deal, yes is nothing without how. An agreement is nothing without implementation. And if your implementation isn't discussed to some degree in advance, then it's a guarantee of a tremendous amount of time lost going back and fixing the mistakes that you should have seen coming in the first place. Or if you haven't talked about implementation in advance, as soon as it starts to break down, both sides go like, well, I'll wait for the other side to start fixing this. So anger and frustration is building. And then when somebody finally does say something, they're screaming at each other. Like, I did a negotiation to put windows in my son's house a few years ago. Contractors, probably pretty much the same worldwide. You know, they take a deposit and they take your deposit to go finish the job that they started 6 months before. And they're not going to do your job till they got a deposit from somebody else. So I know this is what they do. So I negotiated to try to save this guy from himself. If I know that's probably how he's doing business, we're not going to do it like that. So he says, well, you know, how do we do this? You give me a deposit. You know, your windows are in 3 to 6 weeks. I'll call you and we'll arrange for put them in. I said, well, how do I know they're going to be in 3 to 6 weeks? And, well, they always are. They always are. You know, and again, the issue isn't whether or not he answers. It's the process I'm putting him through. So finally I said, okay, address an implementation. So you keep saying the windows are going to be in by 3 weeks. If you don't call us 3 weeks from now to tell me the windows are in, then you give me permission right now to call you on the phone and call you names.
And then what did he say?
Well, he's like, just don't worry. So in 2 weeks and 5 days.
Wow, he shaved off time.
He calls my son.
Oh.
And says, just want you to know the windows are right here. The windows are right here. And we're getting, you know, because I just addressed implementation in a way that he didn't want to have happen. So he dropped all his other nonsense that he was doing with everybody else. Because I addressed implementation up front. We got the windows in. And because I did it nicely, you know, I made him think it was his idea by asking how and what questions. Then when we had problems on down the line also, you know, he handled everything really easily. We, you know, we had an issue with the door. We had some other stuff. But I didn't want any anxiety to build up on the unforeseen problems, which always drop in.
That's amazing. And how did you know what it was that he didn't want? Because he clearly didn't want to be called names.
Right. Well, I did it kind of playfully. And, you know, we went back and forth with him a little bit. Playful and, you know, a hostage negotiation, a late night FM DJ voice. Business negotiations, playful voice, which you do naturally.
Right.
you know, and I don't, I think you probably, your emotional intelligence, you probably just discovered that people wanted to deal with you the more that you smiled and the more that you're playful and pleasant. And at point of fact, that correlates really strongly with how many deals people make and how their long-term relationships play out.
That's really interesting. I hadn't ever particularly thought about that before, so I'll take that. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Now, when one's in a negotiation, you brought up the term anchoring a little while back. I think of anchoring as that psychological mechanism where with the first person that brings up a price, say if there is no price out there, oftentimes the end negotiation might anchor back more closely to that first price that was brought up. I don't know whether it's wise for one to go first in negotiation or not, or whether it depends. But let me just introduce this. Since we have been talking about the sale of a piece of real estate, Chris, in a sense, between seller and buyer, the seller has kind of already begun the negotiation, if you will, because before that buyer even finds out about that property, I can see the price that it's $500,000. I can see this right. Fourplex with 8 bedrooms and 4 bathrooms. So therefore, has the seller already kind of gone first in a negotiation, or does that even matter, or who should go first?
Yeah, well, if you got something that's priced in advance, it's listed, yeah, the seller's gone first.
Yeah.
Now, the anchoring question is a fascinating one, and my academic brothers and sisters will tell you to anchor, and the top-tier negotiators will say he or she who names price first loses.
Interesting, because I thought it would have been to my advantage to anchor and name a price first.
It's to your advantage on the deals that you made. What about the deals that you blew away from the table? And that's the problem, and that's why the academics love it and the top-tier negotiators. Like, I'm horrified that my anchor is going to blow a deal I should have made. And that's why I don't want to leave money on the table. I don't want to not blow deals. And, you know, every top-tier negotiator, and I can remember, you know, over a steak and a scotch, Ned and I, Coletti and I were talking about this too. And it hasn't failed. The people in the business world that are known as the top tier negotiators believe he or she who names price first loses. Because the other side goes first, that's information. Great negotiators are data loving people. You go first, you're giving me data. What happens if I like the price? Now I'm like, oh, here's I can take this and I can let you believe you had your way. This is a really good price for me. And if I get you to emotionally dig in on this price, which you accidentally gave me a great price, you don't even know it, I'm going to make this deal. Now, how often does that happen? How often does it have to happen? I want to make every deal possible. I do not want to lose a deal over price. Dropping an extreme number drives deals from the table that I should have made otherwise. Now, what we do, as opposed to price anchoring, we do emotional anchoring. I will say to you, look, I give you my price, but you're going to hate it. I mean, I'd love to give you price. But it's going to be so extreme that you're going to get angry. You're going to scream at me. I'm scared you're going to get mad. And now I'm going to shut up. So you're going to imagine a price that's worse than what I'm going to throw out. Now, when I do come up with my price, you're not going to get mad at me because by saying, go ahead, you know, just tell me what it is. You've already braced yourself for news that's going to be worse than whatever I say.
That's a really great technique. You've emotionally anchored me to think about a certain number in my head before any number's been said.
Yeah, because of that, you know, that survival negative wiring that we were talking about before.
Yeah.
I'm just kicking it into gear to my advantage. I know how it's going to work, so why don't I use it to my advantage?
That is a really great point and something that I had not thought about previously. And yeah, now we might think about sellers in real estate differently. They are the ones that have anchored a price first. So in that case, what might be some other good techniques to get a lower price if you're a buyer without making the seller feel like they were being burned or taken advantage of. Of course, real estate's about more than price, but a lot of people think about price.
Well, first of all, I'm going to strip away the negativity about me by calling it out. Like, look, you know, especially if I'm coming in as a real estate buyer, I'm going to start out by a real estate investor. I'm going to start out by saying, like, look, you probably think I'm just another shark that's here to pick your pocket, cut your throat. Somebody that doesn't care about you. Somebody that is, you know, I'm a marauder. I'm a plunderer. I'm a pirate. I'm a sociopathic killer. What that does is it disarms people. It calls out the negatives in advance. You know, you don't get rid of the elephant in the room by ignoring the elephant or denying that the elephant's there. The business negotiator's mirror, the black swan negotiator's mirror. You know, it's not the body language thing that everybody's familiar with. You know, it's not they put their hand to their chin, you put your hand to their chin. You know, they lean to the left, you lean to the left. It's not that body language nonsense. It's a repetition of 1 to 3-ish words. You teach yourself the skill repeating the last 1 to 3 words of what they just said. When you have done that enough times, yeah, then you move it around. You get surgical with your mirror. You mirror what you want to hear more about. It's a great skill that does 2 things simultaneously. It gets the other side talking. Gets him to expand. It's much better than what did you mean by that. Much better. You get a much cleaner download of their actual thoughts. It's also a great skill when you are caught off guard. Like they just said something that just doesn't make sense that your brain has just stopped. If you practice the mirror, it's a great way to buy yourself a whole bunch of time to get your feet back under you. The other side doesn't know you did it because they feel like you're really listening and they want to talk some more. The funny thing about the mirror that I have found really interesting is the few people that are both high IQ and high EQ, and I'm not high IQ. And EQ is learnable. I believe, you know, I work very hard at my EQ. But the natural born high IQ, high EQ people love mirrors. I think it's because it's so simple and it's so effective. And that type of person loves simplicity and effectiveness combined into one. And I've seen consistently the smartest negotiators, very high IQ people love to mirror all the time, which I get a kick out of because, you know, I just do it because I was taught that it worked. I wasn't that quickly attracted to it till I see really smart people. So I pretend I'm really smart by doing it.
All right. So we're talking about EQ, emotional intelligence, and the technique of mirroring that you use in negotiation. So for example, if you've got the $500,000 fourplex building you're looking to sell, I want to buy it. Say I'm interested in price. I might try to break you down and say something like, well, it looks like the roof only has 5 years of life expectancy left on it. What would you say?
All right. So I'm selling and you're questioning the roof and you want me to mirror?
Yeah.
Well, I would say 5 years of life expectancy.
Yeah, I'm afraid in 5 years, that's going to wipe out my cash flow for an entire year when I have to replace that roof.
For an entire year?
Yeah, an entire year of my cash flow just 5 years away. So since it's a 30-year roof, can't you share in the expense with me?
Share in the expense?
Yeah, share in the expense of the roof that you haven't replaced.
Sounds like if we work that out, all the other terms would work for you?
Maybe they would, depending on what we agree to on the new roof and how much we're going to share in this expense that I'd be burdened with if I buy the building.
So you're not worried about how much I'm burdened?
You're burdened?
Now you're trying to mirror me back.
No, but you know what? You did something interesting there when you mirrored me a few times, Chris. You got me to say something I didn't plan to say, maybe you thought that I wanted the entire roof replaced, but after a couple questions, you got me to use the word share. You actually got me down to where now you knew that I was willing to share in the cost of that new roof. And then you knew I wasn't asking you to replace the entire thing. So you actually did manipulate me. Manipulation is probably not the right word, but you did get me to concede when you mirrored me a couple times. And the only reason I mirrored you is because you told me about the technique. So that was really great how you got
it. Let me stop you for just a second too, because, all right, so my observation of your tone was that you didn't feel backed into a corner. Have I got that wrong?
You're right. I was being kind of aggressive and going for something.
But what I was trying to do is, see, the dynamic was we got into a sharing conversation without counteroffers, without argument, without anybody getting upset. You know, I'm creating a collaborative environment here so that I can get you into this idea without you feeling like you got backed into a corner or drug into it. That's what I'm really trying to do. I'm trying to expand the conversation. What we would have seen before is bargaining, offer, counteroffer, accusations, all this kind of stuff, meet in the middle, also the nonsense. I'm trying to take the conversation into an area that's collaborative, but you not feeling backed into the corner. Because if I cause you to feel backed into a corner by taking you there, even if I come out on top, quote, on top in this point, you're going to want to get me back elsewhere. And the fear of loss that you talked about before, we got to get people back at least at a 2-to-1 rate of return to feel even. Danny Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner, behavioral economics, prospect theory, lost things twice as much as an equivalent gain. So if I get you to make a $5,000 concession, you're not going to feel whole until you've gotten me for 10 someplace else. On the 2-to-1 feeling of loss.
Interesting.
That's the hard part about bargaining and conceding, was because we're human beings, it will never feel equitable. And it causes a downward spiral. I want to stay out of that. I don't want to go there. I don't want to trigger enough that's going to get triggered by accident. If we got to get into a back and forth exchange, now I got to worry about how much resentment am I going to trigger? Where you going to pay me back? Which is, maybe you don't pay me back on price. Maybe on something comes up in an inspection nobody foresaw. Maybe something's wrong with the property nobody foresaw. Maybe, you know, that no real estate transaction, just because you got a signed contract, does that mean you're going to close? Anybody that's been in real estate longer than 5 minutes know that does a signed agreement to close is a journey.
There are contingencies in there every time. Inspections, appraisals, sure.
Right. So, I mean, the beginning of the journey is a signed contract. I gotta watch the resentment that gets triggered just getting to the signed contract, because boy, if you feel stung, you gotta double down on me. And that's why we've all heard of deals, $500,000 deal that goes down in flames over $1,500 inspection.
Right.
How stupid is that?
Oh, yeah.
$500,000. That makes no economic sense.
A $500,000 home doesn't sell because they're in an argument about the $500 refrigerator or something. And then people want to save face, right? People want to save face. Saving face is a big deal in a negotiation. Yeah. Even if someone loses more money, as long as they save face, it seems like people with a high ego will be more happy with that if they just save face, even if they lose money.
That's exactly right. I don't want to go there. I don't want to lose a deal because I hurt your feelings.
Right.
That's just silly. So let me do everything I could possibly do to preserve your feelings of integrity and autonomy, because I know problems are coming after we get the signed deal. How many, nothing goes through clean from sign to close, nothing. So if I know problems are coming, why don't I do everything I can to prepare for them?
Yeah.
Mixed use building. This building is in a historic portion of this town. Marcella, you still with me?
I am, and you're coming through clear.
All right. So it's in a historic district of town, which means nothing's going up, nothing's coming down. 98% occupancy. People are lined up around the block to become tenants of this building, and it's for sale. As agents, what do you want to know right off the bat? 98% occupancy, lined up around the block, historic district in town, it's for sale. What do you want to know immediately?
Why is he selling?
That's what our guy wants to know. Why is he selling? But our guy wants to know that despite the fact that he knows that why makes people universally defensive. He doesn't want to make the listing agent defensive, so he doesn't want to ask a why question. So what did he do? Was he intentionally mislabeled, or he labeled something that wasn't obvious. And he said, it seems like the seller must be trying to get out of the market due to disbelief in the future of the market if they're selling. The listing agent said, no. My client is underwater on several properties, and he needs to start offloading immediately. Now, this being a mislabel invokes the law of negotiation gravity that says the desire to correct is irresistible. There's no way that the seller gave the listing agent that kind of, or the permission to release that kind of information to anybody. But the desire to correct this young, inexperienced agent overrode the best interest of his client. It felt better to correct this young agent with the right information than it did to protect the interest of his client. And so keep that in mind. You're going to be afforded opportunities where you can intentionally mislabel a situation, an incident, or an event, and get corrected with more truthful information. You get a less guarded response and more candid information when you are being corrected. So don't be afraid to actually label something that's not there, because they're going to correct you.
How much negotiating is done in a family business? You know, and you know, your son works with you. I've worked with my pops. I work with my wife. I've got people that are family that aren't blood family. How much negotiation is done in that scenario? What have you learned for the person that's listening right now that works with their spouse who, you know, has some logical negotiation strategy they're trying to use, and they're like, honey, if you don't do it, like, you know, you're sleeping on the couch. What have you learned to help people in these family businesses negotiate on behalf of, for, and sometimes against the people they love the most?
Yeah, well, anytime you're trying to influence somebody's thinking, you're in a negotiation. Because if you're trying to influence their thinking, you're trying to influence an action. Action is time. Time's a commodity. That's the most common commodity in negotiations, is time. Occasionally there's money. But most people think just because money's not on the line, it's not a negotiation. If you're trying to get somebody to take an action, to change their mind, to do something different, you're in a negotiation, period.
Yeah.
Now, family, it takes longer to sink in. Like, you know, my son who runs my business, you know, he wants me to get me thinking. We use negotiation skills on each other all the time because our heart's in the right place. The real issue is intent.
Yeah.
You know, I need to think about it overnight. I certainly know if I'm trying to influence his thinking, I got to give him space to think about it. Probably more space than I might need to give to somebody who's not so close to me.
Yeah.
So it's the same. It takes more patience with family because, you know, family relationship is a convoluted relationship that extends anywhere from 20 to
60 years, depending upon how long the two of you have been together. So that just means it just takes sometimes a little longer to sink into the neural circuitry.
Right.
I wanted to get a chance to just address a couple of things that you brought up in the last class. Got a chance to listen to the recording, obviously. And I think it's an issue that a lot of us deal with, whether we're the ones doing it or we're having it done to us. But this idea of, you know, you always want to get the most for yourself, but at the same time, you want them to feel treated fairly. First things first, I love the intention behind it in that wanting to make the other side feel like they made a good deal too, right? As you know, I mean, what's leading that is if they feel like they got taken advantage of or they made a bad deal for themselves, the implementation of that deal in the long run is probably going to leave a lot to be desired, right? Unfortunately, when we beat people down to their socks, one way for them to get back at us is when the implementation goes down the drain. And so I love the sentiment there in general. The one slight tweak that I would make to that, just in its raw format, actually really speaks to a class that Troy is teaching called Caviar, which is all about mindset. And so it's really, really subtle. But when we go from thinking, how do I get the best deal for myself, and change that to how do we make the best deal for us? That's a simple enough mindset shift and a slight enough tweak in the focus that now the intention really becomes more about us rather than what do I do for me? And then as I'm getting everything I need, how do I kind of fix and make them whole at the same time? Right? Instead of making it two separate pieces, you attack it much more holistically. And it's just simple mindset shift. And even more so, adding that in to some degree as you set the stage with your accusations audit to the tune of, I know it's important for us to make a deal that makes everybody better. Adding that as your intro to set the stage is some of the way to inject that into the environment, as it were. But Derek, one of our other great instructors and success coaches, and he's been with Black Swan for a long time. He recently purchased a home, bought a piece of land out there, had a house built. Now, he went into that negotiation with the Ackerman technique. He used that to leave no meat on the bone for this contractor that he was dealing with. I mean, he got every last cent that he possibly could, and for all intents and purposes, made the very best deal for himself when it comes to the economics and the dollars as could be made, right? I don't think he could have done any better from that regard. In short, Derek's house got finished almost a year later than expected. And so, yeah, up front, right, he got that win of every last cent. But he beat the contractor down so badly, right? This contractor's got a lot of jobs going on, as many contractors do, as many companies do, right? Dealing with different clients, entities, vendors, what have you. And when it comes to prioritizing in the long term, it's very easy to prioritize the jobs you're making money on and very easy to let the others fall by the wayside. And so Derek kind of found out the hard way, right? Beating him down to his socks actually caused like an 8-month delay in the house getting built. And they went through periods of time when they couldn't get this guy on the phone, right? For all they knew, he jumped on an international flight and left the country. And so, you know, to your point, Christopher, and it's why I love that you brought this up, because that is such a delicate, fine line to play.
The three negotiation mistakes that are hurting your deals are: number one, listening to respond versus listening to understand; number two, using I understand; and number three, asking yes oriented questions. Now let's dive in. Number one, listening to respond versus listening to understand. This is the big problem. And where really all of your problems stem from. Most people don't listen at all. And if they do listen, they listen to just go, aha, or to contradict, or to jump back in, or to tell somebody why they're wrong. I'm sorry, this is self-centered stuff.
To quote Gerard Nuremberg, a negotiation guy that I studied way back when I first started this journey, he said, listening is as much about sensing emotions as it is about hearing words. If you're listening to understand, you're sensing emotions. You're trying to figure out where they're coming from. You're taking a focus off you, and you're really putting your focus on them and their perspective and their facts and how they feel about their facts. What has affected them and what kind of reactions has that perception of those effects had on them? That's listening to understand. Now, number two, using I understand. Now, you might say this being very well-intentioned. You might say this because you're trying to express to the other person that you do understand. And this is a misinterpretation of the Covey advice from way back when, seek first to understand, then be understood. And a lot of people, in a very well-intentioned way, will say, I understand, as if it's going to make the other side feel better. Now, your intention is good, but your application is going to fall short. Never in the history of mankind has somebody said to another person, I understand, and stopped there, and had the other person say, oh, thank God, and instantly feel better. Your goal of trying to make them feel understood is the goal. Not that you understand, but that you make them feel understood. And unfortunately, saying, I understand, doesn't make anybody feel understood. As Brandon Voss has always said, if we could reach in your brain and take out the phrase, I understand, entirely, you'd probably be better off. The other problem with the application of this is that most of the time that people have heard this, somebody has said, I understand, but, and then told them why they were wrong. Well, this doesn't make anybody feel good. But is an erasing word. But erases the intention and the words of everything that came before it. So even if you meant to make them feel good, as soon as you said but, you wiped it out. Now, the second problem with I understand is a lot of people think, okay, so if I do understand, that means that I can tailor my message and it'll really hit home. So in a very well-intentioned fashion, you take as much time as you can beforehand to try to understand. You research them, you research their situation. You research everything you can about them. And then you think you do understand, and therefore you can talk and they can listen, and your talk is going to be that much more effective because you understood. No, the goal is to make them feel understood. And the only way you can make them feel understood is to articulate, to express their perspective back to them, and look for the words, that's right. That's right is what people say when they feel understood, and that's what you're going for. You're not going for your right, which is when you're pitching and they're just asking you to stop talking. You're going for that's right. Finally, number three, asking yes-oriented questions. No. Now, I know you're probably doing this, and I know you're achieving some success with it. That's the problem. People achieve some success with this. We live in a Las Vegas world. The Black Swan group and a Black Swan method is to get you off of the gambling table where you win 10% of the time, which is probably what you do with yes-oriented questions, and move you onto the gambling table where you win 80% of the time. It's about increasing your percentages. There are those of you that are out there that say, I make deals or I come to agreement with yes-oriented questions. That's my data. Yes, you do. And you are not making as many deals as you could make. Now, you could be asking yes-oriented questions of very respectful intention. You're just trying to respectfully confirm that something is true. And from a very early age, you were taught that when you heard the word no, there were problems. Because it's usually the first word that every kid learns. No. Why? Because every adult is pointing at them when they do something that they didn't mean to do but was wrong, and an adult points at them and says, no. I mean, everybody's got stories about that. It was the first word their child heard. I don't understand why my kid says no all the time. Well, because you were pointing at him and saying no. So the experience of hearing no has been drilled into our head since we were toddlers that no meant bad. Well, if no is bad, yes must be good. Actually, that's the problem, because empathy is about the other side, how the other side feels. So while we were horrified when that adult pointed at us and said no, actually the adult felt good. The adult felt like they were giving direction, and it made them feel safe and protected. And this is one of the critical issues of why no is a great response, but also simultaneously, while we're horrified by it, we think yes is success, therefore no must be failure. Well, who says yes is success? As a matter of fact, there's three kinds of yeses: confirmation, commitment, and counterfeit. And so many people use yes confirmations to try to get people into yes commitment that they get really good at yes counterfeit. And also, everybody's been bashed by this. The entire world is yes battered. Everybody's been walked into a deal or some agreement somewhere at the early stage of their life by a series of yes-oriented questions, and suddenly they found themselves in the middle of something they didn't want to do. And they were scarred by it. They were battered by it. So what happens if you ask a respectful yes question to somebody who's already yes-battered? Well, what happens to an abused child when another adult, being very well-meaning and knowing that hugs are physically good for people, walks up to this abused child and raises their arms? Doesn't matter where your attention is, the child is still going to duck. They're still going to recoil. They're still going to pull back. And this is one of the insidious habits that a lot of people get into in a very well-intentioned fashion, that it is slow erosion and toxin on all their relationships. So to recap, number one, instead of listening to respond, listen to understand, and work on sensing the emotions when you're understanding so that you do understand. Number two, instead of saying I understand, demonstrate what you understand, articulate it, make them feel understood, especially with the emotions about their feelings that you sensed when you were listening. And number three, get out of yes-oriented questions entirely. Just stop doing it. Drive for that's right versus yes. Or even switch your yes-oriented questions around to no-oriented questions. Great example is, instead of saying, have you got a few minutes to talk? Ask, is now a bad time? Just to experiment with the conversation. Good luck implementing the Black Swan method. And the more you prepare, the more you'll be ready for the next life-changing deal that falls out of the sky.
We're in long sales cycles, pretty complex deals. They tend to like you, whatever, but they're not ready to move forward with the negotiation, the deal, the contract, or whatever. Stay in touch. They're not saying no, which I'd rather they ghost or say no, because then we can move on, but stay in touch. So what would be, you know, a couple of ideas you might think of how to stay in touch? You know,
Let's rethink this. First of all, that's the same as a maybe, and you got to treat maybes as if they're no's. So that's mm-hmm. where you got to proceed. After saying stay in touch, it's either flat no, they're not going to do it, or they have misgivings that you're not revealing. Mm-hmm. So you know that to be true. Like, are you keeping your percentages, your win rate percentage, your length of time to an outcome, and your percentage of successes on your stay in touches?
A percentage of stay in touches to success, yes. We call it more of a pull through yield, meaning deals we put in the pipeline to success ratio, it's really high. It's about 85%.
But this is more the. You answered my question. Hold on.
Yeah.
Stay in touch as a category only. You can tell me what percentage of the stay in touch people, let's call them a zebra or a giraffe. Okay. or a thoroughbred. I don't care. Mm-hmm. They're one profile. Mm-hmm. Stay in touch. Can you tell me what percentage of those close and how long it takes to close? Yes or no?
Yes, I could. I could. Yes, I could. Yes.
Okay. So can you, so first of all, it's not a sin to not get the deal. It's a sin to take a long time to not get the deal.
Correct.
So if they're saying stay in touch, what do you know to be true?
That they're not saying no. They're somewhat amenable to terms, but whether it's timing or pressure or something on their side that's not motivating them to be enough to turn the dial to let's sign the retainer.
All right, so they have misgivings or they lack pressure or they don't see the immediate value. Nobody Correct. Says stay in touch on something that they see immediate value to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Otherwise, they'd execute. Sure. Either if they see immediate value to it or if they have pressure to execute, they'd execute.
Mm-hmm.
So
good point.
The response is going to be a label. Stay in touch. Sounds like you have misgivings.
It's a good point.
Stay in touch. Sounds like there are other things that are pressuring you. Now, they're going to be much more likely to talk with you about the barriers than they are to talk about what's going to hook them.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are comfortable talking about what's getting in the way because they don't feel there's a commitment involved. So they're free. I'm free to tell you what the barriers are. It's up to you to solve them. If you want to say, well, what would it take to make this deal? I don't want to say that because it's going to back me into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to focus on the barriers instead. And you probably want to go after that with labels. So I would never, you know, and I got to tell you something. Nobody in my business development team goes into stay in touch mode. And a lot of what we've learned will be inspired by similar to Jim Camp Start With No, 2002 book. I work with Jim. We collaborated over a lot of stuff. Me and his sons, Jim has since deceased. Their whole approach was to get somebody to make a decision, yes mm-hmm. or no. But every conversation was designed to make a decision. And stay in touch is to avoid decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a maybe, and it's never, never land, and you cannot monetize maybe. To some degree, you can monetize. We're not making this deal because then you can move on. So I would never go into stay in touch mode. I get stay in touch. What do you know to be true? You know they don't see the value right now. You know they're being pressured in other areas. You know they have misgivings. You know those things to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Throw it out with a label. Focus in on that. They're going to be much more likely to talk with you.
I like the take on that. Very good. I love it. Thank you. You're a rock star, man, but you know.
That was a great question. Thank you very much for the question.
Thank you. Pleasure. Bye.
All right. I can help. Let me see. There we go.
Thanks, Tej. Good stuff.
All right. We have another question. From Willie David. Willie, I'm inviting you up on the stage.
All right. I like the way this is working. It's like driving a new car. I gotta learn. Ah, there he is.
Hello.
Hello.
Read your book. Got your Black Swan manual right here. I've used it a couple of times.
Oh, very good. Right.
Question. What do you do when you get a yes? Specifically, you know, I asked a pizza parlor, they made a wrong pizza for me. They closed. I went back the next day and I used, is it ridiculous to ask for a refund?
If someone's looking to
buy. Nice paraphrase, by the way.
I want to make sure I capture that. If someone is looking to buy, wanting to buy something, acquire right. something, whether they're buying a business, a car, a house, some potential expensive item, a jewelry, something of more value than $1,000. And they might be able to negotiate a lower price. You mentioned the extreme price anchoring, how that is a mistake, right? There's a house for $1 million. I'll give you 200 grand for it, right?
Right.
But you want to get a better deal.
Right.
maybe it's a Rolex, maybe it's a car, maybe it's a house, maybe you want to acquire a business, whatever it is, something of higher value, a ring, an engagement ring, you're going to marry someone.
Right. Let them make their profit off somebody else.
Yeah. What should be the lower percentage on a higher item of value? What should the initial offer be? You want to get a better deal. So you don't want to pay $1 million for a home, but you really want the home. You don't want to pay $3,000 for the diamond ring, the engagement ring, but you really want that ring.
Right.
How low of a percentage should you go to anchor in order for you to feel like, oh, I got a great deal and I got the thing I wanted and they didn't get screwed over? You know what I mean?
Well, depending upon the context. I mean, like 30% is a good rule of thumb.
To start at.
Well, for a target. Like if you, very, very context driven.
Sure.
Like, for example, I'm in Macy's one time and picking out this jacket. Girl I'm with really likes it. She searches the thing extensively. She finds like a thread out of place.
Mm.
And she goes like, watch me get 10% off on this jacket. And I'm like,
thread out of place.
I can get 30% by being nice.
No way.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Well, in every transaction, you know, I look at it as there's an aggravation tax. Now, the person that you're dealing with has already built in the aggravation tax because of all the aggravating people that have come through the door ahead of them. So there's an aggravation penalty, there's an annoyance tax, there's an aggravation tax that's already there on a price. Now, if you're not aggravating, you don't need to pay the aggravation tax.
Interesting.
Let somebody else pay that aggravation tax.
And you benefit from them actually paying that tax.
Yeah, let somebody else pay it. If I'm not aggravating, why should I pay the aggravating tax? So, you know, this young lady, she'd gotten 10% off on a regular basis. I will be demanding 10% is the annoyance tax when there's another 20% to be gained.
Interesting.
Like you don't, so many people don't realize how much money they're leaving on the table.
Really?
Like massive amounts of money. On any given, the difference between 10% off and 30% off.
Right.
Like they got a way to give you a better deal if they feel like it.
So how do you get them to feel like it?
Well, so yeah, great. There you go. Exactly. Again, the approach, very similar to the hotel thing. You know, there's a strategy where we sort of bundle the skills in a black swan method. We call it the accusations audit.
The accusations audit.
Accusations audit. Let me do an audit of all the names you would call me if I'm going to do this.
Uh-huh. You say this.
You say it to yourself.
Okay, not to them.
Because I need to come up with a list. So, again, it's like, look, you get annoying people coming through here all day long, every day, want something for nothing. I'm going to look like another one of these annoying jerks that's really demanding and rub you the wrong way and don't appreciate how hard it is for you to work in this jewelry store, this car dealership, this wherever you are. You are knocking yourself out in a tough sales job.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to feed your family. People are coming here trying to take food out of your mouth. Because how do they see it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not about you. And it's really not sympathy. You know, the difference between sympathy and empathy. You know, I feel your pain.
Right.
Like, I've been there too. You know, like, I'm a regular guy like
you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, don't give me that regular guy stuff. So, but you look at people like me, you want something for nothing, who come walking in all the time. You know, you look at us as wanting discounts and, you know, and you're trying to feed your family. Now, suddenly, this person is like, oh, wow.
They get it.
This is not the other annoying jerk that came in here. Now they're starting to open up. And then, you know, you talked before about being playful. Being playful about this can be a really big deal.
I've gotten so many things for free for being playful, or upgrades or discounts just by, let me just say, a friendly joke or just something funny.
Right.
You know, let me just be goofy and dance in front of them and be like, what is this guy doing, you know?
Yeah. You don't got to pay the aggravation tax.
Yeah.
And then plus, see, Sean says you're 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind. Not only have you put the person in a better mood, you now got them thinking about options.
Mm.
What can they do? How can they help you? What can they get away with? How can they shortcut the TSA line? How can they, what's the code for the employee discount? Like I, you know, in this in the same place where I'm trying to get this 30% or so off, and I'm joking around with this guy.
Sure.
You know, and one of the things get him to see as a human being, I'm like, well, I'm Chris. Is there a Chris discount? What kind of Chris discount is there? And they laugh at that. And so, and I'm still not getting enough of a discount. And finally, I go like, look, give me the employee discount. Mm, now, I've been joking around. And I smile when I say this. This guy goes like, if I give you the employee discount, I got to pay for this thing myself. And I go, I'll pay you back.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm laughing and he laughs. And so he looks at the machine and I says, wait right here. And he walks around and I see him and I walks up to a person and I perceive to be the manager. And he's whispering in the manager's ear. And I see this manager standing there going like, no, really? And he comes walking back and another employee intercepts him, whispers in his ear. And I see his eyes light up and he walks over and he plugs in a discount for me. And we get to 30% off.
Wow.
But I was joking with him. I was showing I knew what it looked like from his perspective. I'm getting myself out of this aggravation tax thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let somebody else pay the demanding, aggressive, mm-hmm. annoying tax.
Mm-hmm.
You go in there and you brighten somebody else's day up. You leave the world a better place. You get some practice in
because
you want that confidence for the big negotiation.
Right.
And all these things work for you. And you end up feeling better about the day yourself.
Yes. You get a fun interaction.
Yeah.
And you got a discount.
Exactly.